I got a fever, and the only prescription is more Patrick Madrid. Come on!
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Cyrus, did you know that replacing your potato chips with grapefruit as a snack, you can lose up to 90% of what little joy you still have left in your life?
That sounds about right. Yeah, figure out something.
A friend sent that to me, and I said, hey, do you mind if I put that on Twitter? He said, yeah, go ahead. So people are enjoying that one. I do like grapefruit, though. Hey,
do you know when most diets start?
I know this is a joke.
Tomorrow.
Oh, I get it. Yeah, it's always tomorrow. It's never today.
That's right.
That's a good point. So, and tomorrow is only a day away.
I also like. Oh, go ahead. Sorry, I'm walking.
You know what? I'll
lines.
Stop talking. You
no,
go
it's
ahead.
It's your show. It's your show.
I have another one for you. Ready? I posted this one on Twitter yesterday. It didn't start with gas chambers. It started with one party controlling the media, one party controlling the message, one party deciding what is truth, one party censoring speech and silencing opposition, one party dividing citizens into us and them, and calling on their supporters to harass them. It started when good people turned a blind eye and let it happen.
Mm. Wow.
That is so true.
Who wrote and that?
I don't know. I saw it. It's in the form of a poster. So I just grabbed the picture of it and I posted it. But obviously they're talking about what happened in Nazi Germany.
Mm-hmm.
But let's go down the list here for just a second. Let's one party controlling the media, check. To think of the mainstream news and motion pictures and television programs, I don't get the impression that the Republicans control those things. Do you?
I do not.
One party controlling the message, one party deciding what is truth. Facebook? One party censoring speech and silencing opposition? That's interesting. Where have we seen that happen? One party dividing citizens into us and them and calling on their supporters to harass them? We've seen a lot of that going on. We've talked a lot about that with the critical race theory issue. And it started when good people turned a blind eye and let it happen. So, yeah, I definitely see signs of that all around us. So if you find that interesting or intriguing, or maybe you want to share it on your Facebook page or wherever, you'll find this on my page. I did not write this. I don't know who wrote this. I saw it. It resonated with me. I posted it. So if you want to see it and, you know, copy it or whatever you want to do with it, it's there on my Twitter feed, at Patrick Madrid. And feel free to leave a comment there, too, if you want to comment on that. It sounds like you wanted to make a comment, Cyrus.
Oh, well, we were talking about funny stuff before, and that got real serious real quick.
We were talking about grapefruits and diets.
This thing makes me think, because this is whoever is in control, and if you don't like who's in control, this is going to work for you. I remember when Trump was coming into power and the left was basically saying all these same things. And now the left is in power, but it's all true. It's all true. Interesting. I don't know.
I don't think 5 years ago any of that was true. I think it was true of the left then as it is now.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just as much in control of those things as they ever were. So, hey, yay.
Yay.
Here's a balloon, Cyrus.
Thanks.
Okay, so let's get into Pope Francis's motu proprio, in which I've read it to you. We've commented on it throughout the last week or so. And essentially, as you know, it is it's a reversal of what Pope Benedict XVI did with his motu proprio 14 years or so ago, in which in Summorum Pontificum he said he wanted the traditional Latin Mass to have the widest possible availability and told the priests, you're free to celebrate this, you don't need to get permission, encouraging even parishes to allow for a traditional Latin Mass if some group of people were to request it and there was reason to think that they would be, you know, going there on a regular, stable basis. So that's the backdrop to this story. Well, this is another example of a bishop who is closely reading what Pope Francis said and implementing this as he sees fit. Now, the thing to remember is that the bishop in the motu proprio that Pope Francis issued, he specifically says to the bishop, he says, you are the sole competent authority to decide these matters in your diocese, and I'm leaving it up to you. So I need you to decide what's the best way to handle this. Here are a few things. The readings, for example, must be read in the vernacular language. They can't be read in Latin. And he had a few other specific things like that. So this, in this case, this comes from the Diocese of Springfield, Illinois, Bishop Thomas Papraki. He issued a decree, and this is as of the 19th, so just a couple of days ago. I'm reading here from calcatholic.com. We'll get a link to this posted so you can read it for yourself. So Bishop Papraki of Springfield, Illinois, who is a canon lawyer, he dispensed two parishes in his diocese from an article of Pope Francis's July 16th motu proprio, meaning that they will be allowed to continue to celebrate masses in Latin according to the 1962 Missal. Now, this is interesting because he took a similar approach to what many bishops around the country have done, which is to say, as the competent authority, as the Holy Father has pointed out, I have the right and the duty to determine how this will go in our diocese. And many bishops now, just within the past several days, have said, and I deem it that we will continue to have the traditional Latin Mass. You can assume that if you have permission to celebrate the traditional Latin Mass, that you still have the permission. And then, of course, to be faithful to what was required in the motu proprio from Pope Francis, the bishops are also saying, and because it's now required that you send a letter to me asking permission, send a letter to me, and I, in the meantime, you have permission, and I will grant you permission when you send a letter to me, just so we have that particular detail covered. Well, Bishop Papraki, excuse me, he's doing essentially the same thing, but he's doing it in a slightly different way, which I find fascinating. So in his decree, he said, Eucharistic celebrations are permitted at these locations using the Roman Missal promulgated by St. John the 23rd in 1962. That's the so this is another way of referring to the traditional Latin Mass in that form. So it's permitted at these locations on any or all days of the year. Now, one of the two churches is Sacred Heart Church, administered by priests of the Canons Regular of the Society of St. John Cantius, SJC for short, the church part of the parish of St. Catherine Drexel in Springfield. The other parish in question, St. Rose of Lima in Quincy, is a personal parish administered by the Priestly Fraternity of St. Peter, the FSSP. Priests of both the Society of St. John Cantius and the FSSP offer traditional Latin Mass. Pope Francis's motu proprio, Guardians of Tradition, issued last Friday and effective immediately, allows individual bishops to authorize the use of the traditional Latin Mass in their respective dioceses. Previously, Pope Benedict's 2007 Apostolic Letter Summorum Pontificum recognized the rights of all priests to celebrate the traditional Mass and did not require them to obtain the permission of their bishop to do so. A provision of the new document from the Holy Father, from Pope Francis, says the bishops are to, quote, designate the locations of traditional liturgies, adding that they cannot be offered at parochial churches. Now, that means your parish church. So a parochial church is a parish church. And the new letter, the new motu proprio from Pope Francis says that that is no longer permitted. So Archbishop Papraki, he, in his decree, he cites Canon 87 of the Church's Code of Canon Law. And this is to back up his decision to issue a dispensation for these two parishes in his diocese, because they are parochial churches. The canon says, this is Canon 87, a diocesan bishop, whenever he judges that a dispensation will contribute to their spiritual good, is able to dispense the faithful from universal and particular disciplinary laws issued for his territory or his subjects by the supreme authority of the church. And of course, the supreme authority of the church is the Pope. So the canon specifically says that if a diocesan bishop deems that by granting a dispensation that would, in other words, the particular church or the priest would not have to abide by this universal disciplinary law that was issued by the supreme authority of the church says that a bishop has that right to do this. So Archbishop or Bishop Papraki's document is unique in that it is a decree with canonical dispensations. It's not just an episcopal statement. So he includes in his decree, since it will contribute to the spiritual good of the faithful to the extent that it may be needed, a dispensation is granted from Article 3, Subsection 2 of Traditionis Custodes, authorizing the use of the 1962 Roman Missal at the parish churches of St. Rose of Lima in Quincy and Sacred Heart in the Church of St. Catherine Drexel in Springfield. In accord with Pope Francis's requirement that readings at traditional masses be proclaimed in the vernacular, Paprocki authorized those parishes to do so. The new papal document also details the responsibilities of bishops whose dioceses already have one or more groups offering the traditional Latin Mass. It mandates that bishops determine these groups do not deny the validity of Vatican II and the Magisterium. Bishop Paprocki determined that several such groups operating in his diocese fulfill these requirements. The groups include the Canons Regular of the Society of St. John Cantius and the Priestly Fraternity of St. Peter and the Canons Regular of St. Thomas Aquinas. So that's an interesting and I'd say encouraging development in the way that these requirements from Pope Francis are being implemented. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Maria in Austin. Good morning, Maria.
Good morning, Patrick. I was just wondering if you can retell your story of St. Teresa. I have someone who, someone dear to me who was going through a breakup, and I was trying to retell your story, and I was just wondering if you can retell it, and I'll take it off air.
The story about the rose, is that the one you're thinking of?
When you had a breakup in...
Yeah, okay.
And you
I remember your wife.
Yeah.
I remember.
Thank you.
Okay, you're most welcome. Well, I was going out with a girl that I really liked, and she really liked me. And I knew Nancy as a friend, and we would see each other on an ongoing basis as friends with all of our other friends. And when this relationship with the other girl ended, I was really very forlorn. I was a hurting cowboy for quite some time. I was hoping that we could get back together again. And it was one of those odd things where I kind of, I didn't break up with her, but I kind of did. And then that made her mad. So then she broke up with me. And then I tried to get back together again with her, and she said no. So it was one of those odd things that just fell apart. And I was in pain. So I made a novena to St. Therese asking her to help me. Now, in my mind, I was thinking to get back together again with this girl. And so that was my intention, or at least that was in the back of my mind. And so I made this novena to St. Therese, who is known for when people make novenas to her, that very often there's some form of a rose that's given to the person making the novena, usually in some very unusual way, an unexpected way. And that's been understood by many to be a sign that St. Therese is praying for you. So in my case, I'm, you know, dragging around, long-faced, depressed, because this girl won't get back together again with me. And I'm hanging out with Nancy and a bunch of our other friends. And she gives me a card, like a Hallmark card. And she had written a note in there about how, you know, she realizes that I'm feeling sad and she hopes I feel better. But the front cover of the card was a rose. So when I got that, you know, my brain thought, oh, this means that I'm going to get back together again with that girl. But it rather quickly became clear that no, not only am I not going to get together with that girl, but Nancy and I started going out. And she's the girl that I wound up marrying and having 11 children with, and now 27 grandchildren. We've been married for over 40 years. And that card, which I misinterpreted the first time around, actually, I do believe, was a sign that St. Therese said, yes, I am praying for you. And guess what? The person who gave you the card is the person that you're going to marry. So that's the story in a nutshell. I haven't thought about that in quite a long time, but it's a great memory. Let's go to Leticia now, listening in Boise, Idaho. Hi, Leticia.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So I've noticed a lot of times when I have kind of discussions or debates with some secular friends, I realize we kind of often get to the question of why is communism so bad and what's dangerous about communism. So I was wondering your thoughts on that and if there's any like official church teaching on that.
Oh, yes. The popes of the 20th century, up to and including Pope John Paul II, were avid foes of communism. Now, that communism wasn't the only danger, it wasn't the only menace that the church faced, but it was certainly a big one. And so I would just say take a cue from Pope John Paul II, who he didn't single-handedly defeat communism. He had some help from people like Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, God bless her, one of the greatest prime ministers England has ever had. And he helped them, and they helped him, to essentially bring down the Soviet Union, the evil empire. So especially in his actions, more than in the things that he might have written, you'll see a strong opposition to godless communism. Now, you see this in the writings of the popes, and if you go to the Vatican website, vatican.va, you can actually read many of their encyclicals and other documents that they issued in English or any other language that you might choose to read it in. So that would be a place that you could get some like specific quotes if that's what you're looking for. But what I would say is that communism is wrong, number one, because it is an institutionalized denial of God that uses atheism as its maxim when it comes to subjugating people. So the essence of communism in the form that it took, for example, in the Soviet Union, was an alloy of atheism and the brutality of the totalitarian regime that was erected and was a death machine. It was just all about forcing people to conform. Their ostensible goals, at least going back to Marx and Engels, for example, and even Lenin to some extent, their ostensible goals were to provide the proletariat with the food and money and resources that they were being deprived of by the former imperial government. And yeah, I'm sure the imperial government did not do well by the people for quite a long time, but what was substituted for the imperial version of misery was even more, it was more misery in the form of communism, because although they said, we're here to help you, what they did was they purged the people that disagreed with them. They restricted completely things like free speech and freedom of assembly, the right to worship, and all in the name of communism, which was intended, or so they told the people, it was intended to liberate them from the subjugation of the ruling class, the moneyed class, the bourgeoisie, the middle class who had some money, and the people above them who had a lot of money. They were deemed to be the enemy, and the oppressors and the proletariat, which was the vast majority of Russian people, they were the ones who were told to rise up and to destroy that system. Well, the system that replaced it was even worse. So a book that might help you kind of get your feet wet in this issue is called United States of Socialism. It's by Dinesh D'Souza. United States of Socialism, Who's Behind It, Why It's Evil, How to Stop It. Now, what I like about this book in particular is that it gets into the historical roots of socialism as we see it in this country, which is really just kind of a warmed over version of communism. And how did communism really get started? And what happened when it got started in places like China and like Russia, to use two big examples? And what are some of the vestiges of that failed political theory that are present in the United States now? And as the title says, why is this evil and what can you do to stop it? That would be maybe the best book of the many books that I've seen on this issue. I think that's about the best one out there at the moment. So you might want to start with that one.
Okay, awesome. Thank you. That's good information.
You're most welcome. Thanks. Oh, one other one. I really like the educational videos that are produced by Prager University. So you can pop over there, and they have a whole section on political theory as well. It's PragerU.com, P-R-A-G-E-R. And these are free videos. And there's, and in some places, the left is so afraid of these that they seek to have them banned in places like YouTube and other venues. So that's a good sign that because they can't refute these arguments, they seek to silence them. And that should tell you a lot.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Awesome. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Good to talk to you. Break time, it looks like. We'll do that now, and we'll come back with more of your phone calls. Also, I'm going to explain to you in fine detail the information that your car provides to third parties about you on a daily basis. This will blow your mind. I'm going to tell you all the specifics when we come back right after this. The programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Yes, I get by with a
little help from my friend. That's much better, Cyrus.
That's better. You like that much a little better. More?
It's getting better all the time.
Patrick gave me an earful about playing Joe Cocker's version of that song.
I'm not a fan. But I do like the Beatles. Okay, real quick, before we proceed, and I am going to get to the ways in which your car tells third parties about you. First of all, I want to read to you a letter that was sent by Bishop Jaime Soto. He is the Bishop of Sacramento, California. And he wrote a letter to his clergy. This is published by Cal Catholic. So if you'd like to read it for yourself, you can find it on the show Twitter feed at P Madrid Show, or just go to relevantradio.com/Patrick and you can see everything there. So here's the letter that Bishop Soto wrote. Dear brothers, please dedicate more prayerful preparation to preaching on the 17th through the 21st Sundays of Ordinary Time, July 25th through August the 22nd. With the exception of Sunday, August 15th, the Solemnity of the Assumption of the Most Blessed Virgin Mary, the Gospel readings will guide the Church through a reflection on the 6th chapter of the Gospel of John. This offers a providential moment to reflect more intently on the mystery of the Eucharist, the Bread of Life. The bishops of the United States have proposed a Eucharistic revival for the Catholic community in the United States. Preparations are being made to begin the revival in 2022 to 2023, culminating with a Eucharistic Congress in 2024-2025. While plans are still being elaborated for this national pastoral initiative, I encourage all of us to begin now, inviting the faithful in the Diocese of Sacramento to renew a love for the Eucharist and rekindle a desire to unite ourselves with body and blood of the Lord Jesus. The Sundays dedicated to the reflection on the 6th chapter of John provide a good opportunity to teach about the mystery of the Eucharist and encourage more devotion to this most blessed sacrament. Research has shown that many Catholics do not appreciate the mystery of the Eucharist. They do not grasp being present to the Lord's Last Supper and kneeling at the foot of the Lord's cross on Calvary as we offer the Mass. They do not recognize the real body and blood of the crucified Christ under the appearance of bread and wine. Many members of our community may still be hesitant, or some may even be indifferent to returning to the Sunday sacrifice of the Mass. The Sundays dedicated to the 6th chapter of John can be an occasion for renewed outreach and catechesis. The Eucharist also offers us the path to a greater communion of mind and heart in this fractious time for society and the Church. And that, again, is the letter that was issued just a few days ago from the office of Bishop Jaime Soto for the Diocese of Sacramento. And I, for one, am delighted to see this taking place. I am so happy that this is underway, and I will be praying, especially for all the clergy who are going to be following the lead of Bishop Soto in preparing their sermons to help revitalize a faith in the Holy Eucharist among the flock. And you can read that letter for yourself by going to relevantradio.com/Patrick. Let's go to Kyle in Savage, Minnesota. Hi, Kyle.
Hi, Patrick. I just wanted to make a comment to your last caller before this last break.
Uh-huh.
I literally tuned in about the last quarter of it. I'm not really exactly sure what you shared, but I think her question was wanting to learn more about communism.
Right.
And I'm reading a book right now that might offer a good perspective on some history. About Marxist-Leninism and communism in general, and kind of specifically even how it relates to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And
do you have a book in mind?
It's a book, yes, I do. It's a book called by Paul Tangor called It's Either a Pope and a President or a President and a Pope.
Okay.
I don't know if you've heard of that book.
I've heard of Paul Tangor, and I know that I think he substitutes for Drew Mariani, if I'm not mistaken, from time to time. I just pulled it up. It's called A Pope and a President, John Paul II and Ronald Reagan, An Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century. So, yes, I have heard of that book, although I have not read it, but it looks fascinating.
Yes, it's about an inch and a half thick, and I can't put it down. I think you'll see at the top of the book, you'll get a picture of it. I think it's one of the finalists of the World Book, I don't know, competition or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a fascinating reading. Your previous caller would benefit from that as well.
Yeah, it says finalist for Book of the Year, World Magazine. So,
there you go.
Yeah, well, that's a good recommendation. I appreciate you bringing that up. And how far through the book are you right now?
Oh, let's see, I read it every morning. I've been reading it for the last probably 5 weeks, so I have about half an inch to go.
Okay, very good. Well, thanks for the tip, Kyle. Let's go to Michael in Elmhurst, Illinois. Hi, Michael.
Hello. My question is regarding the chronology of the events at the resurrection, specifically regarding today's gospel, Happy Feast of Mary Magdalene, and the where they said they have taken the Lord from the tomb. We don't know where they put him, and ran to tell Peter and John. But then it says Mary stayed outside the tomb weeping. So mm-hmm. where did she run to tell them? And then I think they ran ahead, and then did she follow them and then stay at the tomb? Or
the it seems that she did. Yeah, it seems that she did because of the way at least that reading today is written. It's very interesting how the Lord appears, at least in terms of what's recorded, how the Lord appeared to her first, and then she told the apostles, and they didn't believe her at first. You know how the story goes. But it's interesting that she has this very central role post-resurrection. And
the apostle to the apostles.
yeah, as she's often called. That's right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, all right. So that's our, you know, it's just where she ran ahead and then she said she stayed. So it's where she seemed to have accompanied them back again or maybe trailed behind them and then stayed at the tomb. Okay. All right.
Now I can give you,
thank you.
You're most welcome. I can give you a little resource that might be helpful to you. So if you go to Catholic Answers website, catholic.com, they have the entire the Catholic Encyclopedia, the old one, it's digitized and available. And in the article on Mary Magdalene, there is a great deal of the biblical instances where she appears, and you can actually glean that chronology from looking at the different passages in the Gospels where she appears and what she does. So if you want something that's kind of all laid out in front of you, that's where I would go.
Terrific. Thanks very much.
Yeah, you're most welcome, Michael. Thank you. How about Kimberly in San Diego? Welcome, Kimberly.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to say thank you first. I'm 52 and was raised Catholic, but I'm still in the infancy of my Catholic faith, let's say. And about 10 years ago, I believe God started putting people in my path to really bring me back to the church, and found an amazing parish and Bible study group that you just felt overwhelmed with the Holy Spirit anytime I, you know, walked onto those grounds, and had to move and have been really searching for that. And you have definitely filled that gap. I feel like I'm getting my own personal Bible study every single morning and lesson in our faith. And so I just want to say, I know everyone thanks you and you hear it all the time, but for me personally, it's been amazing. So I want to thank you for
thank
that.
You.
And then my question for you today is the Latin Mass that has happened in the letter or the, you know, I'm not sure what the correct terms, but what the Pope has said.
The motu proprio?
That the bishops need to, I guess, essentially approve whether they can do the Latin Mass or not, or their priests can do the Latin Mass or not. And I don't really understand what the big controversy is, because it just sounds like, okay, you ask, and if you're doing it appropriately, then the bishop will more than likely grant that to you, and maybe I'm totally misunderstood. But my specific question is, what is happening in the Latin Mass that the Pope says, hey, we need to make sure this is being done correctly, and so I want the bishops to approve these Masses? And again, my understanding is very primal, the level in which I'm understanding the Catholic faith. So forgive me if I'm not using all the right terms.
Oh, don't worry.
But that's
That's what I want to know.
Don't worry about that a bit. It's a great question. I think part of the answer must include the fact that there are any number of bishops and priests, and probably more priests than bishops, and thankfully not that many bishops, who are hostile to the traditional Latin Mass. They don't like it. They don't want it. They think it's retrograde. They think it is dragging the church backward instead of going forward. And so out of that hostility, there is a desire in the minds and hearts of some people to want to see the traditional Latin Mass go away. So this plays into the bigger question about the survey that was sent to at least some of the bishops by the Vatican, asking for their opinion on how the traditional Latin Mass, how was that experience in their diocese since the promulgation of what Pope Benedict XVI issued, I think it's about 14 years ago now, his Motu Proprio Summorum Pontificum, which was a strong encouragement of the proliferation of the traditional Latin Mass, in telling priests, you have the right to celebrate this Mass privately, for example, you don't have to seek permission, encouraging the bishops and pastors of parishes to allow for the traditional Mass as freely and as widely as possible. So he was promoting this as a benefit to the church, and I certainly concur with the points that Pope Benedict XVI made. I was very pleased and grateful when he issued that motu proprio. So what Pope Francis, in his letter, he wrote a letter to the bishops of the world as an accompanying document to his motu proprio. And in not only the motu proprio, but more pointedly in the letter, he said that after consulting with the bishops, as Pope Benedict XVI had suggested in his motu proprio, he says, it appears as though, and I'm paraphrasing here, but it appears as though there's a great deal of discontent among the bishops, and that the experience of having the traditional Latin Mass in their dioceses was not a good one for some, and that it caused problems with people denying the Second Vatican Council or denying the validity of the new rite of the Mass or other things of that nature. Therefore, he then, in his motu proprio, essentially abrogated everything that Pope Benedict XVI said and entrusted to the local bishops the authority to determine whether or not and how the traditional Latin Mass would be permitted going forward. Now, I think, and I don't know this to be true, but I'm surmising that I think those who are critical of the Latin Mass, they thought that it would be kind of a done deal, that it would just basically more or less effectively abolish it. But as we've seen in the last week or so, it's had almost exactly the opposite effect, where in many dioceses around the country, because the bishops were entrusted with this special authority by Pope Francis, or maybe he just simply reiterated that they have this authority, they have gone, you know, in the other direction, many of them saying, we love the Latin Mass, it's a blessing, it helps many people, and because I have the authority to do this, given to me by the Pope, I'm saying that the Latin Mass will continue in this diocese. So we're seeing a lot of that, and I think that that is probably an unwelcome surprise to some who were hoping that the opposite would take place. So we'll see what happens. We're only a week into this, but it seems to me that that's what's happened thus far.
So on sort of an elementary level, just to make sure I'm understanding, like if they're before this week when the Latin Mass was happening, there were perhaps priests or parishioners possibly at those masses who were not necessarily there in the right frame of mind or spirit because of their wanting that type of Mass to go away? Or is it the people who are not even attending that Mass that are saying we should abolish this type of Mass?
Well, okay. It sounds like there are, when you say people who are not of the right frame of mind, what I'm thinking of is the people who are denying the validity of the Second Vatican Council, or they deny the traditional Latin Mass, or they disparage it in some, I'm sorry, the new Mass, or they disparage the new Mass in some way. There are people like that, and it's hard to say how numerous they are. In many cases, they're very vocal, so that might give an exaggerated impression that there are more of them than there really are, but it's hard to say. I don't really know for sure. but they do exist. Part of Pope Francis's instruction here was, because of the people who are doing those things, he feels that this is eating away at the universality of the church. It's eating away at or weakening the unity of the church. So his desire, he says, is to foster unity. And what I find interesting is how Archbishop Corleone of San Francisco, for example, Bishop Paprocki of Springfield, in the more and more and more bishops now who have been coming out, Bishop Conley of Lincoln, Nebraska, yesterday, it seems that every day there's at least a handful of bishops who are making these statements. And what I'm pleased to see is that they're saying, in our diocese, this is a real blessing, and we don't see the kind of division and acrimony that may be present in other places, but we don't see it as a problem in this diocese, and we're keeping a close eye on it. So I think that's a very encouraging development, personally.
Yes, definitely. All right. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate the one-on-one time with you. And
you're welcome.
If you ever have the opportunity to be in San Diego and speak or attend a mass here, I would love to come and hear you talk.
Oh, thank you very much, Kimberly. You're most welcome. Thank you. Well, if you're interested in where I'll be speaking, I do speak all around the country. All you have to do is go to relevantradio.com/Patrick, and there's a place where it says links. If you click that, you can go to the section that's got my speaking calendar, and then you can track my movements. And if I'm going to, or the next time I'm going to be in your area, you'll know about it. So thank you for that, Kimberly. I appreciate it. And thanks for the kind words. Let's take a break. And as promised, when we return, I am going to share with you, from a technological standpoint, what your car tells third-party contractors who gather information about you. What does your car tell them about you, and how does it do it? I'll tell you all of that when we come back from this quick timeout. Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
All right, so you get in your automobile and you head to the grocery store, or wherever it is that you go. We all go different places, obviously. Did you ever stop to think about what your car is telling other people about you? Fascinating article in Vice. Headline, Cars Have Your Location. This spy firm wants to sell it to the U.S. military. So check this out. This is some fascinating information, and it affects you and anyone who drives a car. Affects me. Affects you, Cyrus. So listen up, Cyrus. A surveillance contractor that has previously sold services to the U.S. military is advertising a product that it says can locate the real-time locations of specific cars in nearly any country on Earth. It says it does this by using data collected and sent by cars and their components in the cars, according to a document obtained by Motherboard. And the document says Ulysses, which is the company, can provide our clients with the ability to remotely geolocate vehicles in nearly every country except for North Korea and Cuba on a near real-time basis. Currently, we can access over 15 billion vehicle locations around the world every month. Although the company told Motherboard it has not sold the product to the U.S. government at this time, the news highlights the scale and reach of car tracking technology and the fact that car location data is of interest not just to insurance companies in the finance sector, but to government contractors who explicitly say they want to source the data for intelligence and surveillance purposes. Now, I'm going to pause here and say there's another group. Well, there are probably many other groups, but there's at least one other group that's very interested in this data, and that would be the group who wants to out Catholic priests and bishops for doing things in their spare time and sometimes even on the clock that are deeply immoral. And we talked about the story of the high-ranking figure in the U.S. CCB who resigned suddenly because data was verified triangulating his whereabouts using the information that was generated by a hookup app, as it's called, and the pinging of his cell phone. And this is anonymized data that it turns out was relatively easily de-anonymized, which led to this priest stepping down in disgrace. And the upshot of that article, the upshot of the story that the article's detailed in the last couple of days is that apparently there was a whole long list of people whose data was being offered as far back as, say, 2018 to Catholic media outlets, people who might be interested in this information. So even going back that far, it seems there was a list, and who knows how long that list is, who knows how many names or who the names are that are on that list, but basically saying, hey, these are some high-profile people in the Catholic Church, and we have data on the use of these apps and the geolocation of their cars based upon the cell phone signals, and we found a way to de-anonymize it and actually tie it directly to a specific person. Would you like this information? And as it's being reported, organization after organization said, no, we don't want this information. Now, Dr. Janet Smith has a fascinating article that touches on the ethics, on the morality of this issue. And it's called The Limits of a Priest's Right to Privacy. And you may say, oh, come on, that's terrible. Priests have a right to privacy. I agree, they do. They certainly do. And we should protect that right to privacy. But we don't live in a world now where you can assume that you have privacy, especially if you carry a cell phone, which of course you do, and especially if you drive a car, which of course you do. So this brave new world that we live in now entails the ability for people to do previously unheard of things, like being able to tell exactly where you were at any given time on the basis of the apps that are on your phone and where your cell phone was at that time. It's truly, I think for many people, this is going to be truly frightening. It's frightening in a general sense that now your privacy is so non-existent. So let's continue with this article because it gets to the issue of your car. Consumers, that means you, may be unaware that automakers and original equipment manufacturers, OEMs, often include sensors in vehicle parts that collect information such as your airbag, your seatbelt status, engine temperature, and current location, and then they transmit that information either back to the automaker or to third parties. Aggregator companies also purchase or obtain this data. They repackage it, and then they sell that data or products based on it to their own clients. The Ulysses document, Ulysses again is this company that has perfected this, and they sell this technology. They say, vehicle telematics is data transmitted from the vehicle to the automaker or an OEM, that's the third party, through embedded communication systems in the car. Among the thousands of other data points, vehicle location data is transmitted on a constant, near real-time basis while the vehicle is operating. The document specifically suggests that this technology could be used for military operations. We believe that this one attribute will dramatically enhance military intelligence and operational capabilities, as well as reduce the cost and risk footprint of intelligence surveillance reconnaissance assets currently used to search for and acquire mobile targets of interest. It says that Ulysses has, quote, existing access to bulk commercial telematics data. Now, I'm sure that if this applies to cars, it also applies to things like 18-wheelers and ships and commercial airliners. I mean, this is not restricted just to cars. Think back to the assassination of, Soleimani, the top military guy in Iran who was assassinated by U.S. forces. By his car was blown up from a distance. I don't know if it was a Hellfire rocket or what it was, but they pinpointed his car, precision surgical strike, and they killed him and everybody in the car, of course. And how did they do that? Well, I think this has a big part to play in that. How did they know that he was in that car? So, the document continues. Included is a map showing apparent vehicle locations across Russia, Ukraine, Turkey, including along the border with Syria. A section of text next to the map says that Ulysses data access lets clients analyze targets whether you want to geolocate one vehicle or 25 million vehicles, as shown here. The office of Senator Ron Wyden obtained and then provided the document to Motherboard. Wyden spokesperson Keith Chu told Motherboard in a statement that, quote, far too little is known about how private information is being bought and sold. Senator Wyden is conducting an ongoing investigation into the sale of personal data, particularly via data brokers, to put some sunlight on this shady industry. Our office is continuing to perform oversight into where data brokers are acquiring Americans' information and who they're selling it to. So Ulysses, it's a small surveillance contractor based in Charleston, South Carolina. They also say that they can offer whoever wants to buy it cellular interception and jamming technology, hidden video recorders, military training such as tactical driving, and more, according to the company's website. Ulysses has worked with U.S. Special Operations Command, a branch of the military tasked with counterinsurgency, counterterrorism, and special reconnaissance. According to Motherboard, Ulysses says that using publicly available information to analyze how peer and near-peer competitor countries were making economic and financial investments in Africa and Central and South America, SOCOM, again, that's the U.S. Special Operations Command, used this analysis to deepen our understanding on how foreign competitors used economic and financial tools against U.S. interests. Now, all of this is well and good if you're fighting terrorists and criminals and communist China and all of the above. Okay, great. But this data can be used against you. With mobile phones, consumers can generally see what data an app may be requesting, the article points out. And Apple, for its part, recently told developers to add extra information about whether the data was being used to track a user or not. So your cell phone, your car, the apps on your cell phone, these are all ways in which your whereabouts, where you go, who you see, what you do, and me for that matter, and Cyrus, all of us. We've now reached the point where this information can be used to harm people. And yes, if somebody's doing something that's bad or illegal, okay, I can see a case being made for wanting to stop those kinds of things from happening. I'm not wholesale opposed to this. But you can see how it could be used for nefarious purposes if, let's say, whoever buys this information wants to, even just as simple as just tracking somebody or stalking that person. There are all kinds of ways in which this could be used. Now, in the time we have remaining, actually, I don't know if we have enough time remaining for this, but I do want to share with you an article that just came out. This is from Dr. Janet Smith. She teaches moral theology. She may have retired by now, but until just recently, at least, she taught moral theology at Sacred Heart Seminary in Detroit. And she has a fascinating and provocatively titled piece called The Limits of a Priest's Right to Privacy. And the springboard for this issue that she writes about here is the situation with this high-ranking official at the USCCB. He was the general secretary. He is, by most accounts, or he was anyway, the most prominent or high-ranking Catholic clergy member who was not a bishop. And he resigned. And as you know, he resigned because whoever is behind this, and we don't yet know, at least I don't know, approached various news outlets. They approached the U.S. Bishops' Conference, we're told, and going back as far as 2018, said that, hey, we've got some information here that you probably should look at. So here's how it's described in an article that was broken by The Pillar a couple of days ago. They say, an analysis of app data signals correlated to his mobile device shows the priest visiting, let's just say, these establishments of ill repute and private residences while using a location-based hookup app in numerous cities from 2018 to 2020, even while traveling on assignment. According to commercially available records of app signal data obtained by The Pillar, a mobile device correlated to him emitted app data signals from the location-based hookup app, which I will leave unnamed, on a near-daily basis during parts of 2018, 2019, and 2020, at his office, at his residence, etc., etc. So when we return, I'd like to share with you a little bit of what Dr. Janet Smith has to say about this, because this is a far bigger story than I think many people realize, and it may get much bigger than it is right now. And if this is, as I'm saying, if this is in fact correct, I have no reason to think it's not, but if this is correct, that this information was gathered and de-anonymized and linked to specific figures, and a whole list of these figures were being told, and the data about them and their activities was being offered to various groups who claim to have said no to it, that means that that list is still there. That means that maybe there are other shoes yet to fall, which must be an unbelievably agonizing idea for many people who perhaps acted in ways that they shouldn't have, not realizing that this data was there that can easily track them. So this is going to get into the question about what are the limits to a right to privacy. And that's true for you and for me. It's also true for our Catholic priests. And I won't have time to really start that now, but when we return from this quick timeout, I'll share a bit of that with you, and I'll show you where you can get the rest of the article for your own sense. This would be a great reminder, if ever there were one, to live a good life, don't lead a double life, be in private who you appear to be in public, be virtuous, all the things that all of us need to hear over and over and over again. If anything is going to remind us of why that's important, I think this story will. I'll be right back.